Welcome all to the second episode of the Advanced Podcast, where we talk about health, wealth, and happiness, and how to achieve those three things through the internet. And firstly, I would just like to say, if you like what you are listening to so far, please share this podcast with at least one of your friends who you think will be interested in what we are talking about now. Me again, I have my co-host Prav.
Hey man, hey YJ.
And I think yesterday we recorded the first episode, and it was quite an interesting one. We talked about the tweet thread by Naval,
right?
Which is how to get rich.
Oh, it was only yesterday that we recorded it.
Yeah, it felt like
such a lifetime ago. Yeah,
I know. I think we had quite a good discussion about the first three tweets. And for this episode, we're moving on down the list for the next few tweets. And I think we'll cover about three, maybe more. We'll see how things go.
Yeah, with Naval's tweets, you can never predict how long it can take to dissect them.
Yeah, we kind of thought it would be a more quick and easy way to do things, but we just dive deeper and deeper into each tweet.
Right.
And let's start with the first one, which I think will resonate a lot with, which is, you're not going to get rich renting out your time. You must own equity, a piece of a business, to gain your financial freedom. Okay, Prav, first thoughts?
I certainly agree. And the way I understand it is that, you know, we can think of the value of a business, or in this case, a piece of a business, like a call option, you know, where maybe just like a little cost at the bottom of the curve, and then there's just unlimited upside to how much value the business can have. I mean, if you think about it, if you were earning a salary at Zoom, right before the pandemic hit, versus if you were one of those guys who say, hey, you know what, maybe let's trade it in for equity. There is a ceiling for how much you can earn as an employee. But with equity, the sky is the limit. So I get what he means, because you're the only occupations that, you know, maybe they earn a lot off the bat are like dentists. I think like really very specialized tradespeople. But it's still, they're bound by time. They can't scale.
Yeah, for sure. I think time is one of those resources which you really find it difficult to scale, and especially your own time. And I remember this being one of the tweets that really resonated with me, especially the first line, how you're not going to get rich renting out your time. And I think we discussed this in the first episode a bit, about how use time to make money, and how that is not scalable, and how owning an equity, a piece of business, is actually one of the highest leverage things you can do. Like, we see all like those VC venture capitalists that's, they own businesses, and they're all the biggest companies in the world, like with people like Warren Buffett being the most famous example. That's what he does. He owns equities of different businesses, and that is how he essentially got his wealth. And Prav, have you experienced any of these firsthand? Especially, I think we all kind of know about renting out your time. Yeah. We've all experienced that one way or the other. But how about equity?
Well,
and all that.
I'm thinking back, surprisingly, you know, like even though I started off in a startup environment, interestingly enough, like a lot of my equity deals just have not paid off. And I mean, there's not like I've been consistently attempting projects that are entirely manned by me the last few years. I think what's been happening with me is I've been operating as a freelancer. And it's in a sense, if you're a freelancer, you own 100% equity of your business. Right? And so while I've been able to scale that at a much quicker rate, right, in sense of like how much I get for whatever consultancy gigs that I do get in this case, like as a creative consultant, I can get to command more, but ultimately it's not been at the scale of productizing myself. Right. So like, I have managed to increase my amount of wealth by operating as a freelancer, but it's still not the level of scale that that can be achieved by productize myself like the way a musician would, or the way a startup making internet of things stuff for people's homes would.
Internet products and all that. Yeah, I think when I first saw this tweet, one of the first few thoughts I had was this is a very privileged kind of statement, because not many people are able to do that. And owning equity of a business, I think a lot of times, and even myself included, that
do you think case though? Because I mean, if you think about it, a plumber who like through like sheer hard work and maybe a bit of financial discipline could reasonably start up his own business, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
So maybe it's not like
yep.
a very privileged thing for like anyone mm-hmm. to start a business. I think if you find like the service you're willing to offer, maybe that will lead to some upside. Yeah,
I think you definitely have a point there. And I thought about that as well. Like my first thought was definitely that it felt a bit privileged. But thinking about it more, that is what a lot of my peers have started doing as well. Like going that down the route, like what you're with your plumber example, like they are taking more control of their own time, and they're definitely doing the not renting out your time part in terms of they probably work more on their own terms, on their own time. And I think a lot of people are moving towards that, especially when concepts like working from home has been a lot more prominent because of the pandemic. And I think, yes, like owning equity in businesses is definitely not a beginner's thing, which I think why I thought it was you have to have a privilege to do it. Not only privilege in terms of class, but I think privilege of experience, of time, of money to be able to.
But do you think internet has reduced the barriers to entry that privilege last time would have? Because maybe, right now with the abundance of information available on the internet, it seems like you can really find a solution for everything just by Googling it.
Yeah, I think definitely the internet has democratized a lot of these things that we saw were once out of reach, like venture capital and investing in companies, or even like cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. Like there's websites and businesses like Public, which allows you to just sign up for an app and you can start investing in the free market. And even with cryptocurrency, like you just download an app, you sign up, and you can actually invest and buy cryptocurrency. And I was looking at I saw the headline of an article which is decentralizing venture capital. And I think because a lot of people we see VCs and people like Warren Buffett like being out of reach, like the man in the castle. But there are a lot of ways now that you can own equity, even though it's small, but it's still a piece of equity where you can definitely grow your right. money.
Just, do you think that, so, I mean, you've gone into, talking about like capital markets, which funnily enough, I don't immediately think about them when I think of equity. I always think of it as my mind always goes directly to you owning a stake in a business, which, ultimately, yes, is what the share is. But I think I think of it in terms more of private equity than capital markets. And even more so just specifically your own business. So I think it's like 100% sole proprietorship or to a private limited peers. I always think in the scale of a freelancer to an SME. And I think for a long time, because having... interesting. Having studied financial markets, I always found that the upsides were too minimal for me. Like, you have people they are patting themselves on the backs for a 5% return at the end of a year sometimes, and I was like, yeah, just not down for that. Like, I like things with more explosive payoffs. So that's the way I look at owning small businesses. Like, you know, you take multiple bets and having equity on it, and then you just hope for that. That, or rather, it's not hope, but you're just patiently waiting for one of them to strike it big and have the maximum payoff. So,
yeah, for sure.
I tend to say that, like, capital markets, just unless you're really excited by it and then you're really trying to find alpha and trying to find that edge, then I would say go for it. But as a money making strategy, I always believe that it's just scale up your own services and find that thing that field of business, the industry that you're interested in. You know, you might be carpentry and then just follow it, and you probably get more returns for your investment than if you put into capital markets. On a bit of a side note, I always tell like my designer friends and all who are investing in capital markets that you'll be way better off taking your money and actually making pieces of art or home products. Or even open a bakery, you'll probably earn more returns in your investment than putting into capital markets. So I always feel people should focus on that.
I think it also depends on your kind of style and your aversion to risk and how risk averse you are. I think capital markets are quite a safer bet. Like, even though you have your own equity, you are kind of betting on yourself.
So as someone like you who has, I'm guessing, you know, managed some personal investments for himself, at least for a while, like, why do it at all and not just buy an index fund? Well, why the hope that you can outperform an index fund?
I think it's just that control. Being able to have a sense of control of, about the outcome and the potential, and to know that you have an effect.
Do you think that you have outperformed the market in that sense?
No. So, I wouldn't say so. That's why I think it's important to look at, to kind of diversify your portfolio. Like, for me, I would rather do diversify the risk, have some of my own, have some in the public market. Because I think that's, and you just look and see, you know, some things go up and down. You make some losses here, you gain some in another place. It's really dependent on your style, I guess, and your amount of risk aversion. I definitely do not have enough knowledge or experience to give this kind of investment advice, but definitely it's worth looking into.
Which is why, I mean, I think the angle I would love to explore it is, you know, what are the reasons that would make someone actively participate in the trading or capital markets? And yeah, like, yeah, no, I had a train of thought there, but I think I just poofed a bit.
All right. Do you think we can move on?
Yeah, I think we can. Tweet? Yeah.
Right. Which is the next one is, you will get rich by giving society what it wants, but does not yet know how to get at scale.
Ooh. Well, what do you think? Like, well, any thoughts that you want to springboard off?
I think for this tweet, the last part is the most important. The last two words, at scale. I think you will get rich by giving society what it wants, but does not know how to get. It's quite a easy concept to grasp. Like, you look for gaps in the market, you look for, and we see it all around, like innovators, unicorns, things like Zoom. Like, they give ease of doing video calls, which is what the society wanted, but they did not know how to get until Zoom came along. And that's what they gave society. And I think with something like Zoom, they managed to do it at scale. Yeah. Like, everyone basically forgot the word Skype.
Yeah.
It became like mostly Zoom. And I think with, especially at scale, that is what the internet has enabled everyone to do, to give a service or product at scale.
So, you know, like for me, the thing that screams out for me is the first half, which is you know, you're giving society what it wants but does not know yet. And because this is a big pet peeve for me in business development or just product design, and this idea of taking surveys, because I found surveys are bullshit. Like and the idea being this, like it's always attributed to, I think Steve Jobs is one of the people who retold this, but then it's attributed to Henry Ford, which was that if I asked people what they wanted, they would have told me faster horses. And Henry Ford, as we know, is the person behind the automobile revolution, the person who started Ford automobiles. And because people are constrained by their ideas of the past, their past experience. So for that reason, Steve Jobs, for example, refused to do focus groups, because he said people don't know what they want until you show them. And I see, you know, this is Naval's riff on it. They don't know what they want yet, and that's true. And so I think a lot of times, like even when you go and you answer surveys, for example, in businesses, when you're trying to do like market research, or if you're trying to study like, you know, your branding or your creative, and you're trying to test it out, a lot of designers in large corporations like banks, for example, they love, especially UI UX researchers, they love their surveys. But ultimately, one thing that we've discovered via, it comes from a different field. Like this is actually from economics and microeconomics. The one few concepts that economists actually come out as useful, and it's called revealed preferences versus implied preferences. And or rather, is that talk is cheap, right? It doesn't matter what people say, but the real truth is in what they do. So like someone can tell you rave reviews about your product in a survey or their judgment, but their behavior may be completely different. It may translate to something very different in the marketplace. There's even in surveys, people are answering it from the frame of mind like, what would a good citizen say in this survey? So I think the real test is really just putting it out to market. And you know, what people say in terms of what society tells you that they need is a lot of noise. And you know, by putting it out to the market, you really identify what people need. Of course, at scale, then I always look at it that if you can make something to scale, you're tapping onto a deeper truth or understanding about human beings. And like I got that concept from studying someone's review on Taylor Swift, because the guy was saying that whatever your opinions about Taylor Swift, you have to respect motherfucking craft, and that there is a craft to making something pop and appealing, and there's a genius behind Taylor Swift. There's a genius behind pop. And when you understand that craft, you're basically understanding a deep truth about human beings at scale.
Yeah, I definitely agree that scale is still such a tough concept to grasp, even though it's all around us. Like it's hard to imagine scale and how to achieve scale. And definitely the example of music and how the internet has created music at scale, how YouTube has created video at scale. All these were once scarce products, but now they're everywhere. You cannot stop.
And I think
even not
what we spoke about in the previous podcast was about niches. Like you can find a niche for yourself. And I think that's what the internet also allows us right now. So you may not be like a humongous dominant cultural presence out there, but you may just have a small, very niche following of people that are obsessed with your content and obsessed with your products. And I think that's what the internet allows, a lot more niches, a lot more, you know, the long tail kind of marketplace that we will see, where everyone has an audience for their specific niche. So maybe the idea of scale may be like beyond your family, but it will be global and there'll be enough. Like you may have 10,000 loyal followers and customers. Yeah.
And like, do you think you have done anything on that sort of scale before?
I think just the act of releasing content out there puts you in front of so many different people and eyeballs, you'd be surprised. And I barely done it. I barely dipped my toe into that pond. And just by doing it, it just makes you stand out from the crowd. because no one else is doing it, and you just get a lot of eyeballs that way. So I look at creating content as something that people want at scale, and I think just very small attempts at it allows you to reach a wide audience and can open a lot of gateways that you may not obviously see at the moment.
Yeah, and I think content, you brought up a good point about content and how it is one of the most scalable things now, especially in the world, and especially on the internet. Like, there is, internet is meant to scale your ideas and thoughts and share knowledge and information, and all that can be we do that every day. We see that every day on social media. That is aspiration at scale. Right. Like, you are looking at people's portrayal of themselves, right. Like the highlight reel of their life, that is them portraying their aspirational self at scale. And I think it's important for any freelancer or even business to start thinking of themselves that way, which is, of course, we kind of understand that giving society what it wants but does not know how to get yet. I think that we can, I would say most of us would roughly understand if we have done our own freelancing work or worked in a certain company. But I think that skill, but I do not see many people trying to scale. Right.
And
because I think I remember even as a kid, like even when I see that word at scale and understand it a bit more, as a kid, you see superheroes and the kind of powers you wanted, superhero powers you wanted were things like time travel or like being able to fly, being able to clone yourself, being able to transmit your thoughts. Essentially, these are all things you can do on the internet.
Right.
At scale. Like, for me, like, I was recently talking to a friend and asking what's his biggest problem. He says he cannot clone himself. And I'm thinking, you can do that now through the internet. You can literally clone yourself, your thoughts and your ideas. And I think that's a very important point for a lot of people who are thinking of not renting their time out so much anymore, is to start thinking of that, using the internet to scale yourself, and that the internet is kind of like the enabler of superpowers for you.
Very interesting. And, you know, I was thinking earlier what you said about people are trying to manipulate public perception of themselves at scale. And I was like, yeah, that's a very interesting perspective to take on social media. And you know, like a bit of a segue, but, you know, most people, like, this may come as a shocker to most people, like, especially since the world tends to revolve around it. But we don't have a real underlying theory or understanding or explanation of how advertising works. So if I ask you now, AJ, like, okay, how do you, like, what's your common sense understanding of advertising? How does it work? What does it do and how does it
advertise?
Work?
Advertise. Yeah. It persuades people to buy.
It persuades people to something. Buy, right? But then if you look at a lot of company behavior, it may not directly lead to something like a tangible, immediate sale. Like some people believe that it's a salesmanship kind of perspective on advertising. But we've seen ads like Apple, they don't even show the product, like Apple's 1984 kind of ad. So is it really like the old school way of just presenting the facts and then you're like, wow, okay, I know now the facts, I'm rationally going to buy this product. Or the other theory is a form of emotional inception, where if you show Michael Jackson and you show Pepsi together, that feeling that you get when you watch Michael Jackson is the feeling that you get when you consume a Pepsi. So like that's one perspective on how advertising works, that emotional inception. But does it really? Because even things like we learn in psychology, like the Pavlovian kind of experiments, like that, where you still need to immediately provide the stimuli when you ring that bell for the dog. You know, so if people aren't familiar with the Pavlov experiment, it's like when they would ring a bell and serve a dog food to kind of bridge that connection between the stimuli, which is the bell, and then the salivating, which is the response of the dog. And after a while, the dog would just be triggered to salivate just by ringing the bell, even if there's no food inside. So this idea of emotional inception for human beings as what advertising does doesn't seem to make sense either. But we see it echoed all the time, like Don Draper and all, you know, like nostalgia. You're tapping into real feelings and all. And then now there's one prominent theory which makes a lot of sense, which is signaling, which is that if you can signal to large people at scale, you can kind of manipulate culture, which is why events like the Super Bowl are so expensive, because there's a non-linear pricing to advertising, and this explains it. Why it's so expensive to advertise when as the eyeballs grow up. So when you look at the Super Bowl, it's a large cultural event, everyone's attention is there. So if you advertise like your beer at that moment, it becomes a cultural norm. You are manipulating society at scale. The main idea is that the larger your culture bomb, the more expensive it is. Because that's how valuable you, like each incremental new eyeball is in manipulating culture.
Right. Right. And I think you can also see from things like how much people pay for advertising on a Super Bowl. You're basically paying for scale. Like you pay one time, you show it once on TV, a few hundred million eyeballs. If it's 1 million, you pay probably 1% of that price. But if it's 100 million, you pay like 100 million because of the scale you can reach. And I think even as individuals, how could you think about how you could reach scale on your own? Like, do you start publishing your thoughts online? Do you start sharing your experiences? The signal to others that, hey, this is what I'm going through. It could be it could be related to your business. It could be related to your personal life. And then people will start to know that, hey, he is able to do something that not many people know how to do. And I can give you one example of that from me. Like, I recently created an app about pets. So I basically faced this problem that if I wanted to see where to bring my dog, I had to look at different websites, different articles, which give you a long list of places you can go with your pet, like pet-friendly cafes. I'm like, I don't want to look through this shit anymore. It's too much to... I don't want to go through this garbage. And I basically consolidated all the information and I used the no-code tool to create an app. Basically, it's a directory on where to find pet-friendly places around your area.
Interesting.
So, it's super easy. You just put it in a Google Sheets and it populates it for you as a list and it appears on a map. So, for example, you just put in your... just turn location services on. You're in the east. These are the pet cafes around you.
And what no-code tool did you use?
It was called Glide. G-L-I-D.
So how does it run? Like on your phone, I mean?
So it's basically a web app. And on an iPhone, you can just save it as an app. So it becomes like a home... like one of those icons home on screen. Your screen. You just tap it and it uses your browser to open up the app. It doesn't go back to Chrome. It just opens as a separate... it looks like an app, basically. And all you had to do was go to Google Sheets and you input the data. And it helps you format it. It helps you create a table for you. It helps you pin the location on the map and all that. And that was something... like, people were surprised that I was able to do that. They were like, wait, you do computer science, you... like, how long do you spend on this? And I was like, oh, a day.
Right. I think people don't know what's available out there in terms of tools.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not something that is unavailable. You can use it for free. But I think when you start thinking about this, like being looking for ways to give society what it wants but doesn't know how to get... and I think you can start looking out for things like this. Like, this is what I think people, like pet owners, would want. So I put it up on Instagram. I say, like, oh, who wants access to this? Just let me know. And I just send them the link. And people actually wanted it, but they did not know how to get it. They did not know how to do it. And if you can start, like you could even open an agency purely on Glide. Say, I can make an app for your company just like that.
Yeah, shit.
Because companies don't know how to do it. And you can do it at scale. Like, it basically, if I wanted to start an agency like this, I would just hire a freelancer on Fiverr. Like, dude, I'll...
but what level of complexity can you achieve with this Glide app, for example? How sophisticated is this tool?
Not very sophisticated. It can be quite... It can create a Tinder clone. It can create a... Yeah, so my idea from that was actually to create a Tinder clone, which is like basically a matchmaking app. But instead of matchmaking person to person, you match activity to activity. So for example, I swipe right. Is it right? Yeah, I swipe right on playing basketball, and you swipe right on playing basketball, and we both swipe right, we'll match.
Right.
So something like that.
Okay, it'll be perfect for hobbyists.
Yeah, exactly. And for it'll be perfect for people looking for others with similar activities. Like, and people don't really know that they are able to do that. And you can, and the important part is you can deliver it at scale. You don't have to go through the app store. You don't have to go to like the Play store. You can just send the link that, yo, this is a link. You just download, just save it on your home screen, and you can just match with other basketball players. Like, you can be the basketball, the Tinder of basketball. And there's very similar things like that.
Well, that's pretty cool.
And I think this is important for people to just get to look out for. And it's just simple. You can go to just Google no code tools, and probably one of many will come up.
No code tools. I think it's strange that there are so many powerful and easily accessible tools out there, but we still are very unaware of these conveniences, man.
Yeah, exactly. And like I was, when I speak to people, even though around our age, like we would think we are very internet savvy, that we know how to use the internet well at its like highest capacity, but actually no, I think like we use only like 5% of it, the power of it. Like how many people have a podcast? How many people has a YouTube channel? How many people have a blog? Like, these are things where you can scale yourself infinitely. And these are things that will work for you while you sleep.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's super important to start thinking about it.
Check out the tools, guys. That's how you...
Yes, check out the tools. Many of it are for free. Like, it's not going to cost much. Like, for the pet-friendly cafe app, it was free. Because they charge you based on after a certain amount of users.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, so you could use it for free until like, I think 50 or 100 users, and then they start charging you for it.
Well, this is a very interesting payment model.
Yeah, I can see Prof.
Yeah, like, I'm thinking like, huh?
Like, what kind of,
like, I'm so curious that you can just duplicate and make something like a Tinder clone, you know, without knowing any code at all, you know. So that's...
Yeah, and they are templates, and it's all templatized. Like, you could buy, if you don't want to create it from scratch, you just buy a template for $50, $100. You just input your own data in. And you could even do it for like, people use it for workout apps. Like, basically, you don't have to host your videos on the app. You can host it on YouTube. And each workout is a link. So you just click, you just go to, just play the video, which is hosted on YouTube. It's just embedded on the
itself.
The
app. Nice.
And you can create your own workout app.
Wow, this is the... Very, yeah, I'm still processing this. It's pretty impressive.
I think you could also do it for like things like therapy and
yeah, and certainly. That, like, I'm trying to see if there's any dots to connect there.
Like, maybe Prav, what is one of the biggest issues you have with working with your clients?
Okay,
like, operationally, or
I guess for now it would be scheduling, right? It'll be scheduling, right. And yeah, how they pick the appointments. It's mostly that.
Definitely, there's an app for that. There's a website for that. I think it's called Calendly.
Right. Okay, I've seen ads for those, Calendly.
Yeah, Calendly. It's free to use. You just send the link to your... You just set your own available times. You send the link to your client, say, just choose which available time. And it basically sends... So if they select a time, it automatically... You create an email and it sends that email to that person. Like, this is the Zoom link. This is the time. Please confirm. Reply to this email if you have anything for Prof to prepare for the call. And let's say you cloned yourself. You saved yourself 10 minutes.
Why not?
10 minutes.
Like,
and you can do it at scale.
At scale, man. I think that's the... Apart from leverage, is going to be some of the keywords that we're going to be using. Leverage at scale.
Yeah, and another example I'll give if I think it would be interesting, like I was speaking to my friend who's a video editor. He's a freelance. He just transitioned to freelancing as a video editor. And I was talking about him to him, and I was asking what some of his problems were and all that. He said, liaising with a client, all this client work, onboarding them and all that. And in my head, I was thinking, how could you templatize that whole process? Because look, first you can use Calendly to set up a call. Or even before setting up that call, you could create a Google form, or there's this website called Typeform, which is basically like a form website, but it looks nicer. And you could ask like that client basically in their form, like, what are your biggest worries? What is your budget? What kind of video are you looking for? And then they can type this all. You don't have to ask them. You already put on the question.
And what's the name of the site? Typeform. Oh, okay.
Typeform. Yeah, like Prav, you could even do that for like your practice. Like send them it's basically a pre-onboarding survey or something like this, a questionnaire.
So what does it do? Like create a chatbot in some sense?
No, it's just like a normal form, like a Google form. It just looks nicer.
Got it.
But even Google Forms, no one really uses it.
Yeah, that's true.
And you could basically use that to help ask the questions you would have normally asked face to face. And then after they filled up that form, you could send them a Calendly link. If you want to book a call, book call here. And that will save you like 45 minutes of your time for each person that wants to contact you. And you times 10 that, you times 100, you times 1,000, that's how many minutes of your life. Right. So yeah, start using the internet and all these free tools out there to replicate yourself at scale.
Right. I mean, you're here, you're saving time, right? Which is the most valuable resource that you have.
Yeah, and you save time to be able to do the most important
thing
to you, or the most important work, the best work, and not be bogged down by all the $5 an hour work. You have to be bogged down by the $1,000 hour work, which is worth
your time. I feel like it's a bit of a paradox, but I do feel like what these tools do is they kind of also make you more humanized in the process. Because, like, if you notice, for example, maybe if you're you're an executive with a kind of executive PA, right? There's a bit of a detachment from the process, as if, you know, you're using like another employee as a firewall. So when requests come in, it's filtered through your secretary before it arrives at you. So I think this is not ideal. And like you can see the example, for example, the writers who outsource their work. It loses a bit of soul. So some people are working through all elements in their business process is very important to them. They don't want to outsource it because it's a very existential feeling for them. So I actually believe these tools allow you to, because ultimately they do cut short time without the need of a human filter. Right. So like it's still all directly feeding towards you. So I think it solves this thing of it being a more time intensive process, but allows you to still make the business very much about you and not involve other human beings in it that kind of detach you from the process. So I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like when I was working with a startup and we were looking for a branding agency. And so I went to meet several of these agencies, and every of these agencies I was met with an exec. They would like walk me through their deck, asking me what I want, what's my budget, what kind of specifics do I need for the project. And I felt I had the same conversation like several times with different agencies. And only when you talk to the person that is behind that high level work, do you really truly understand what that agency or that company does. Mm. And a lot of the times, I think if you templatize that kind of process, it saves you time both for yourself and also for your potential clients. Because like having a conversation, you have to do the little small talk. You have to kind of get over the pre-conversation jitters, like you're meeting your first date for the first time. And I think templatizing all that will definitely help you, not say totally erase that, but it will help you understand the client more. before you actually hop on a call with them. And that will allow you to do your best work, which I think is important for a lot of us to grasp. Like, we get bogged down a lot with the $1 an hour work, the $5 an hour work, and this takes the energy and motivation away from your best work, which is a pity, because there are so many ways to outsource your menial work, your $5 an hour work, to tools on the internet for free.
Interesting. $5 per hour tools.
I think with that we can actually go on to the next tweet.
Which I find the one that is the most vague in a certain sense. Right.
Pick
an industry where you can play long term games with long term people.
Actually, when I first heard it, I did not think it would be vague. I did not think of it as vague, because I kind of had this concept in my head since I was younger. And why is that? It's because in Singapore, by the time we hit 16, we got to choose where we want to go, JC or poly. If you go to poly, what course will you want to take? Accounting, business, optometry, mass communication, which is what I took in the end. And when I spoke to adults at that time, I remember a lot of the time say, yeah, just pick something that you can get a job or you're interested in. But in my head, I'm like, okay, yes, that's true. But what can I do for a long time? Like, I think about it, like, accounting, it's numbers and all that. It seems to be able to, anyone seems to be able to do it. Like in my head, or like engineering, it's a science and all that. But I think about communication, and it's something quite uniquely human, and where I can kind of play a long-term game in. Like, I could always be a communicator. I could always try and practice my creativity. Mm-hmm. And I saw that as a very long-term game, not so much like a five-year plan where I took a diploma in accounting and I went on to study more accounting and I just worked at a company. That seemed like the goals were very solid. It was always there. But it wasn't very long-term to keep doing that for the rest of your life. Like, I saw the communication as a more long-term industry, a long-term game that I wanted to play. And yeah, do you think you had any experience with that?
I mean, I know that I felt as a teen and above, like, that I might have had. But looking back, they lack a lot of specificity. And I think a lot of it is just fueled by what you can probably call a short-term game here, just wanting short-term status and short-term validation. So I never found that right fit in a lot of places simply because I didn't find a long-term game yet. So I think for a lot of young people, especially, and now the term young people is stretched quite a bit, right? So even if you're in your 40s, I think any stage in life can apply to you where you may not have tried enough things to just find that thing that you want to commit for a long term. It's just like dating.
Mm.
Not all of us have had that fortune or that self-awareness, for example, to meet someone and say, like, okay, this person really does have all the values that I could possibly look for in a person, a compatible kind of chemistry even. So we can do it. Most of the time, it's a lot of exploration. And in that process, you might find your preferences also change. And I think it's the same with careers and industries that you want to work in. So, I would say that the closest I've received to a long-term game in my entire life is going down the lines of therapy or becoming a therapist. And even I don't know for sure if there's a long-term game.
Right.
So,
right.
On a side thing, you look at my table here, right? It's just right in front of me. You'll see this whole bunch of yellow notebooks. Right, so very distinctive. I have a whole drawer here full of them, and what they are is essentially a notebook in which I write affirmations. And So my affirmations tend to be centered around character. Like previously it used to be like, I want to earn, when I was younger, like 5K per month. And, right. You know, I'm basically like trying to orientate my psychology towards manifesting this thing in real life, like my entire focus and all that. So, but as I became more introspective, then I realized that, wait a minute, do I really want that? Like, what am I really looking at this for? And, you know, it felt like you can orientate your life to like writing, if it's as simple as that, right? Writing into a notebook 15 times a day in the way like Scott Adams would tell you to do an affirmation.
Yep.
And it will come true. Like, what would you want to direct your focus to? Is it like, you know, you're writing every day in your notebook, I want a date, I don't know, Jade Rasif or something. Like, is that a valuable use of your mental energy? Or if you wrote something like, you know, I'm going to be like the world's best seducer. Likewise, maybe that really is the most fulfilling thing for you, but is that the most valuable? Or like you put being a billionaire, you know, like trying to direct your focus. So I found that ultimately at the end of it, I think if you aim at crafting yourself into a very worthy individual, the rest will follow. So for me, that's a long-term game, character formation. So that's right. How I've been kind of orienting myself to it, because I always believe that if mindset is settled, you wake up in the day and you'll be able to generate $1 million just by that focus and activity and energy that you bring to your craft. So yep. Is there a long-term game for yourself? Like, that you see yourself, like, with the little YJ in 30 years or 50 years' time? Like, what's the long-term game there?
I think for a long-term game, I think it's very tied to your purpose as well. And I think for me, I'm just starting to figure out what that purpose is. And for, I think, to put things into context also, I'm not sure if, have you heard this term, finite, infinite games?
It's, as in Naval uses it quite a bit, right? But I think, I think I've heard him use, because it's a game theory concept and he likes that.
It's originally from James Carse, Carse. Mm-hmm. And that's his definition of it, which is there are at least two types of games. One could be called a finite game, the other an infinite game. So a finite game is played for the purpose of winning. An infinite game is played for the purpose of continuing the play.
Right. Which is a very intrinsic kind of motivation.
Yeah, and I see that very close to purpose. Like, what would allow me to wake up every day and consider this fun and play? And I guess for me, that would be creating content, and not only for myself, but helping other companies be able to do that as well. And because I think all my life, like, I was interested in stories, in movies, in music, in books. And these stories are still the way we communicate a lot. It's kind of the main way we communicate a lot of things. Like, even on social media, on YouTube, even through podcasts, like, all these are basically forms of a story. And I think for me, that is close enough to what I consider an infinite game I want to play, or a long-term game. And I am still slowly trying to grasp the concept for myself, but it's definitely something to always look out for. What is a finite game? What's an infinite game? Like finite games are definitely what I've been playing the past few years. A lot of the times, like, all these get rich quick things, all this going out at night, getting drunk, all these are relatively finite, because you either get drunk or don't get drunk. What do you really gain? Is it something you can play long term? Definitely not. And even with long-term people, like even for this year, I've been beginning to start to cut out a lot of people I don't see myself playing this long-term game with. Because if they are not aligned with the game you are playing, it's hard to play together. Because games are intrinsically co-op games. We're all playing a co-op game. We're trying to help each other. That's where the most fun is also, I feel. Playing a game, like, single player games are, I mean, you get bored of it, but you know, when you play FIFA, you play alone, your story mode, okay, good enough. But when you play with friends or the energy racks up, you talk shit with each other and all that. It's so much more fun, and you could play FIFA with another person for hours, but you play for yourself maybe 1 or 2 hours. So definitely long-term people. I think these are two things to definitely look out for.
So what do you think about this as an analogy for relationships? Because essentially, that's what you're looking for. Like marriage is a long-term game with a long-term person. And actually, I can imagine, you know, if you go into a long-term game with a short-term person, it could be disastrous.
And it's funny enough you say that, because so I'm reading my notes on Finite Infinite Games by James Carson. He talked about how that about relationships basically, and how he sees long-term relationships as definitely an infinite game. You want to play with each other as long as you can. But then he starts saying, even within that infinite game, there are many finite games to play, like arguments, who's right about this, who, do you turn on the heater, do you turn off the light? Like, a lot of times we put so much energy in these finite games where there's a winner and a loser, but in the end, you are distracting from the infinite game, which is playing together for a long time. And that definitely happens with a lot of, even for singles, like going out and hooking up with other people for short-term, like short-term relationships. These are all finite games masquerading as infinite games, where you kind of propose a long-term relationship, a fantasy of marriage to someone, and you back out of it. In the end, there's a loser and there's a winner.
I mean, I think that's when you live your life without that kind of integrity, the representing yourself as having different goals from your partner, right? And I like the idea of actually like using your analogy of Ora James, what's his name, Carr?
Carr.
His idea of finite games being a subset of infinite games. And it's like, because I always believe that there's a bit of experimentation. We have to go through these finite games before you step into an infinite game. That makes sense.
Yeah, and he also uses a lot of real world examples like schools. Schools are basically very finite games. Like you either get the degree or not. And these 3-4 years are what a lot of people absorb themselves in this finite game for 4 years. And I've definitely done that myself. Like when I was in school, my goal was basically to be the top 10% of my class and do well in school. Right. And I did play that game and I played it well, but it was also because I had this motivation of wanting to make my parents proud. So that to me was a finite game within an infinite game of my parents being proud of me. I think we can spot a lot of that in our lives. I think a lot of things like arguments and even war itself is a finite game, because there is a winner and a loser.
And war as a finite game. Interesting.
Yeah, it definitely is. It's a finite game within a...
Because you know what's interesting? You mentioned game. That. Because when you were talking, right, my mind was just end this game. Because I feel like no conversation about game theory. And I know game theory is a very strictly defined field, but, even fictional concepts like Ender's Game and the game concepts that you use there, I find that very interesting in how it influences our thinking. Like, if I'm not wrong, it's required reading for like the United States Army's Command Staff College. Like Ender's Game is one of the books that, or Marine Corps, like one of the recommended books reading, because to kind of train you to do this kind of strategic level thinking, right? And so he talks about ending all future battles, right? It means winning an infinite game in a certain sense. And what that means is, for example, in his mind would be attacking an enemy to the point where they can't retaliate ever. So you, like with that maneuver, you end all future battles, right? So like just ideas they're talking about. When you talk about war being a finite game, and I'm like, huh, interesting. Then what is the infinite game if war is the finite game? And I suppose it's like you win this one battle to win the infinite game, which is to end all future battles. But is that possible? Like, is can we fully prevent war? Stay tuned to the next episode to find out.
but yeah, I think it's also important to kind of really understand what a infinite game is, which is you don't play within the rules of a game, you play with the rules. Because the strategy of an infinite game is to keep everyone in play.
So have you heard of the concept from Star Trek called the Kobayashi Maru?
Yes.
Because I think people who don't follow Star Trek, like myself, I was more of a Star Wars person growing up. But I found this concept very interesting because it's repeated by a lot of thinkers and even in the media.
Mm.
And the idea being that to be an officer in their space force called Starfleet, when they're in the academy, they will need to sit for this test called the Kobayashi Maru. And the idea being that the game is basically unwinnable. You're put into a simulation and essentially the game is unwinnable, with the main lesson being that they want the commanders to learn how to deal with an unwinnable scenario. Like if you're a captain of a ship, you need to be able to face death, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And how the main protagonist, Kirk, James T. Kirk, he wins is by essentially changing the conditions of the test, cheating. So the idea being that if the game is rigged against you, then the only logical move is to cheat. Right. So
or play with the rules.
Right. So, but that's what I'm asking you. Like, what do you think? Like, do you believe about exploiting things within the rules, or kind of taking a step out and just changing the fundamental rules of the test? Right, okay, this is a bit like very broad ideas already, but I've always been a fan of it because there are certain things, like even in our history, like the US, one of the things attributed as a strategy for winning the Cold War, and they wanted to do it without firing a single shot at the enemy, right, was that they outspended the USSR. So one of the strategies was that keeps pumping up defense spending, and this was during the time of Ronald Reagan, and just by keeping up the Russian economy, the Soviet economy will collapse. And it worked. So this is all unconventional thinking to kind of.
I am 100% a fan of that. And I think there is a whole group of people that, not saying that we are looking for ways to cheat or play or not, I think we are looking for ways to play the system.
Mm-hmm.
Like, look, these are the rules set by, let's say, society. But who is enforcing it, or who is saying that you can't do something another way,
right,
or in another method, like the Kobayashi maneuver, was it?
Maru. It's like a Japanese maru word.
Kobayashi Maru. And I think we see that all the time with big businesses and big business magnets all around the world. That's how Steve Jobs, he changed the game. Like, everyone was like, oh, you have to create computers that the consumer can play with, they can upgrade. But Jobs was like, no, I'm creating my own rules. Mm-hmm. And now Apple is the biggest company in the world. And same as Microsoft, like, they played by their own game. Everything was mostly open source. You accepted as much as you can. They played by their own game. And now Elon Musk, space travel before he came on was basically one way to do it.
Right.
And now he's basically making it accessible for people to go to the moon or even Mars. And these are ways that people have worked with the rules. Right. Not say against it,
right,
not say do anything unethical, just play with the rules.
Right. So
hack the system as much as you can.
I see something very interesting emerging from the conversation, which is that there are very interesting properties about these rules that govern society that people may actually have a wrong idea about. Like, we live in a world where we think that might is right, where the stronger, the one with the bigger numbers, can win or ultimately dominate or influence the decisions of the whole collective. But in exploration of ideas like minority rule, which was fleshed out by thinkers like Taleb, he shows that, you know, for example, if we were to go to a buffet, a company buffet, it's likely that even though that there's only a few Muslim guests, that the meal will be halal, because it just makes more sense to have a halal meal where everyone can consume it versus having two different buffet lines where to cater to different people. So this is an example of minority rule where the small influences the collective. And right. And we've seen that through history. Like, one of my favorite people to study in history is Charles de Gaulle, the leader of the French resistance during World War II, and then subsequently their president and the leader of their government. And what he would say, he was a pain in the ass, a thorn in the side of the British and the Americans. But what he would say is, it's because he was powerless, because he was a rebel, like he was a leader in exile. And because he had nothing, that's why he had to be difficult to work with. So there is like an Elon Musk, an Apple level of stubbornness that makes sense. Stubbornness is a strategy where Apple just says, nope, we're not going to budge and we are going to go wireless. And the whole world is just forced to adapt to them.
Yep.
So stubbornness and being a minority, like in sense of numbers, doesn't mean you're powerless. Paradoxically, it can mean that you have a lot of influence. And I think that is some of the key insights, for example, why Singapore is successful. Like, we are always of the view that, Singapore's smaller, like we will die in an attack. But that's not actually how reality operates. A small country, just by sheer virtue of being stubborn, right, to great powers like the US and America, gives us a lot of leverage, because they are the levers and Singapore is the tiny little handle, you know, influencing the world. So I finally warmed up to your leverage concept, man.
No, not mine, the miles, but I think once you see it, you can kind of see it everywhere. Especially the concepts we've been talking about so far, these are things that you can definitely apply to yourself almost immediately if you start seeing it. And it does take time to be able to understand it and see it around your own world, because I haven't really understood it fully. I don't think either of us have. But the more we see it happening, the more it kind of like, shit, I understand these things a bit more. And yeah, I think that was
a
good conversation.
Yeah, I feel like we can definitely keep going, man.
We can do the next one, the next episode, which is about playing iterated games, that all the returns in life, whether in wealth, relationships or knowledge, come from compound interest. And yeah, do you have any first impressions of that before we
dive in, right? Well, I think we did touch a lot of about it in the course of our conversation here, right? Like, I think we expanded on these ideas a little bit. Like, what are your initial thoughts on?
I think compound interest is a concept I've only thought about with money. But actually you can apply to all aspects of your life. And I think it would be interesting to see how our experiences have mirrored that or can improve from that.
The reason I'm kind of tiptoeing about it, because I do think there's a value to it, but in the last few years, my way of thinking has shifted from the kind of compound interest or like, you know, things increasing exponentially to the model of you may making small, steady losses, like small amounts, and then bam, a large deviation, a big explosion happens. So people will be like, they both sound like about the same thing. But I think it's just that the idea that versus compound interest, another strategy may be, you know, you going through a long period of time without seeing any returns. Like with compound interest, you can sort of see, all right, I'm earned a little bit more before. But in reality, it's a lot more of, well, fuck, I'm not seeing anything emerging from all a series of 100 or 150 bets. It is 151st bet that's going to take off. So, right. Yeah, it's a very small, nitty-gritty kind of thing, I think, to most people. But what do you think about the difference that laid out so far?
I think yes, there's a few things to consider about it. I think let's dive in the next episode for that. It'll be fun to let me gather my thoughts on this and we'll discuss it in the next episode.
So I've poisoned the pot a little bit, but no, I think it's a teaser for next week.
It's a teaser for next week. So I think with that we can end this episode, and I'd like to thank everyone for listening in, and thank Prav for coming on and giving his thoughts as well.
Oh, my pleasure. And thank you everyone for tuning into our discussion. We hope it's as fun as for you as it is for us, because we really do have a lot of fun just discussing this.
And for sure, if any of our listeners would like to chime in, you can reach out to us on Instagram. I think this will be on Instagram. We'll post a thumbnail for it. But yeah, reach out to us. We'll let you know how to, but let us know your thoughts. And if you like this episode, subscribe and share it with your friends. And thanks everyone for listening, and see you in the next episode.
Take care. Thank you.